This is disc number 6.
After a while, these checking compulsions are ritualized. If they feel they have been dirtied, they must clean themselves in a precise order, putting on gloves to turn on the tap and scrubbing their bodies in a particular sequence. If they have blasphemous or sexual thoughts, they may invent a ritual way of praying a certain number of times. These rituals are probably related to the magical and superstitious beliefs most obsessionals have. If they have managed to avoid disaster, it is only because they check themselves in a certain way, and their only hope is to keep checking in the same way each time. Obsessive compulsives, so often filled with doubt, may become terrified of making a mistake and start compulsively correcting themselves and others. One woman took hundreds of hours to write brief letters because she felt so unable to find words that didn't feel mistaken. Many a Ph.D. dissertation stalls not because the author is a perfectionist, but because the doubting writer with OCD can't find words that don't feel totally wrong. When a person tries to resist a compulsion, his tension mounts to a fever pitch. If he acts on it, he gets temporary relief. But this makes it more likely that the obsessive thought and compulsive urge will only be worse when it strikes again. OCD has been very difficult to treat. Medication and behavior therapy are only partially helpful for many people. Jeffrey M. Schwartz has developed an effective plasticity-based treatment that helps not only those with obsessive-compulsive disorder, but also those of us with more everyday worries, when we start stewing about something and can't stop, even though we know it's pointless. It can help us when we get mentally sticky and hold on to worries, or when we become compulsive and driven by such nasty habits as compulsive nail biting, hair pulling, shopping, gambling, and eating. Even some forms of obsessive jealousy, substance abuse, compulsive sexual behaviors, and excessive concern about what others think about us, self-image, the body, and self-esteem can be helped. Schwartz developed new insights into OCD by comparing brain scans of people with OCD and those without it, then used these insights to develop his new form of therapy. The first time, to my knowledge, that such brain scans as the PET help doctors both to understand a disorder and to develop a psychotherapy for it. He then tested this new treatment by doing brain scans on his patients before and after their psychotherapy and showed that their brains normalized with treatment. This was another first, a demonstration that a talking therapy could change the brain. Normally, when we make a mistake, three things happen. First, we get a mistake feeling, that nagging sense that something is wrong. Second, we become anxious, and that anxiety drives us to correct the mistake. Third, when we have corrected the mistake, an automatic gear shift in our brain allows us to move on to the next thought or activity. Then both the mistake feeling and the anxiety disappear. But the brain of the obsessive compulsive does not move on or turn the page. Even though he has corrected his spelling mistake, washed the germs off his hands, or apologized for forgetting his friend's birthday, he continues to obsess. His automatic gear shift does not work, and the mistake feeling and its pursuant anxiety build in intensity. We now know from brain scans that three parts of the brain are involved in obsessions. We detect mistakes with our orbital frontal cortex, part of the frontal lobe on the underside of the brain just behind our eyes. Scans show that the more obsessive a person is, the more activated the orbital frontal cortex is. Once the orbital frontal cortex has fired the mistake feeling, it sends a signal to the cingulate gyrus, located in the deepest part of the cortex. The cingulate triggers the dreadful anxiety that something bad is going to happen unless we correct the mistake, and sends signals to both the gut and the heart, causing the physical sensations we associate with dread. The automatic gear shift, the caudate nucleus, sits deep in the center of the brain and allows our thoughts to flow from one to the next unless, as happens in OCD, the caudate becomes extremely sticky. Brain scans of OCD patients show that all three brain areas are hyperactive. The orbital frontal cortex and the cingulate turn on and stay on, as though locked in the on position together, One reason that Schwartz calls OCD brain lock. Because the caudate doesn't shift the gear automatically, the orbital frontal cortex and the cingulate continue to fire off their signals, increasing the mistake feeling and the anxiety. Because the person has already corrected the mistake, these are, of course, false alarms. The malfunctioning caudate is probably overactive because it is stuck and is still being inundated with signals from the orbital frontal cortex. The causes of severe OCD brain lock vary. In many cases, it runs in families and may be genetic, but it can also be caused by infections that swell the caudate. And, as we shall see, learning also plays a role in its development. Schwartz set out to develop a treatment that would change the OCD circuit by unlocking the link between the orbital cortex and the cingulate and normalizing the function of the caudate. Schwartz wondered whether patients could shift the caudate manually by paying constant, effortful attention and actively focusing on something besides the worry, such as a new, pleasurable activity. This approach makes plastic sense because it grows a new brain circuit that gives pleasure and triggers dopamine release, which, as we have seen, rewards the new activity and consolidates and grows new neuronal connections. This new circuit can eventually compete with the older one, and according to use it or lose it, the pathological networks will weaken. With this treatment, we don't so much break bad habits as replace bad behaviors with better ones. Schwartz divides the therapy into a number of steps, of which two are key. The first step is for a person having an OCD attack to relabel what is happening to him, so that he realizes that what he is experiencing is not an attack of germs, AIDS, or battery acid, but an episode of OCD. He should remember that brain lock occurs in the three parts of the brain. As a therapist, I encourage OCD patients to make the following summary for themselves. Yes, I do have a real problem right now, but it is not germs, it is my OCD. This relabeling allows them to get some distance from the content of the obsession and view it in somewhat the same way Buddhists view suffering in meditation. They observe its effects on them, and so slightly separate themselves from it. The OCD patient should also remind himself that the reason the attack doesn't go away immediately is the faulty circuit. Some patients may find it helpful, in the midst of an attack, to look at the pictures of the abnormal OCD brain scan in Schwartz's book, Brain Lock, and compare it with the more normal brain scans that Schwartz's patients developed with treatment to remind themselves it is possible to change circuits. Schwartz is teaching patients to distinguish between the universal form of OCD, worrisome thoughts and urges that intrude into consciousness, and the content of an obsession, that is, the dangerous germs. The more patients focus on content, the worse their condition becomes. For a long time, therapists have focused on the content as well. The most common treatment for OCD is called exposure and response prevention, a form of behavior therapy that helps about half of OCD patients make some improvement, though most don't get completely better. If a person fears germs, he is incrementally exposed to more of them, in an attempt to desensitize him. In practice, this could mean making patients spend time in toilets. The first time I heard of this treatment, the psychiatrist was asking a man to wear dirty underwear over his face. Understandably, 30% of patients refused such treatments. Exposure to germs doesn't aim to shift the gear onto the next thought. It leads the patient to dwell more intensely on them, for a while at least. The second part of the standard behavioral treatment is response prevention, preventing the patient from acting on his compulsion. Another form of therapy, cognitive therapy, is based on the premise that problematic mood and anxiety states are caused by cognitive distortions, inaccurate or exaggerated thoughts. Cognitive therapists have their OCD patients write down their fears and then list reasons they don't make sense. But this procedure also immerses the patient in the content of his OCD. As Schwartz says, to teach a patient to say, "My hands are not dirty," is just to repeat something she already knows. Cognitive distortion is just not an intrinsic part of the disease. A patient basically knows that failing to count the cans in the pantry today won't really cause her mother to die a horrible death tonight. The problem is, she doesn't feel that way. Psychoanalysts, too, have focused on the content of the symptoms, many of which deal with troubling sexual and aggressive ideas. They have found that an obsessive thought, such as, "I will hurt my child," might express a suppressed anger at the child, and that this insight might, in mild cases, be enough to make an obsession go away. But this often does not work with moderate or severe OCD. And while Schwartz believes that the origins of many obsessions relate to the kind of conflicts about sex, aggression, and guilt that Freud emphasized, these conflicts explain only the content, not the form of the disorder. After a patient has acknowledged that the worry is a symptom of OCD, the next crucial step is to refocus on a positive, wholesome, ideally pleasure-giving activity the moment he becomes aware he is having an OCD attack. The activity could be gardening, helping someone, working on a hobby, playing a musical instrument, listening to music, working out, or shooting baskets. An activity that involves another person helps keep the patient focused. If OCD strikes while the patient is driving a car, he should be ready with an activity like a book on tape or a CD. It is essential to do something to shift the gear manually. This may seem like an obvious course of action and may sound simple, but it is not for people with OCD. Schwartz assures his patients that though their manual transmission is sticky, with hard work it can be shifted using their cerebral cortex, one effortful thought or action at a time. Of course, the gear shift is a machine metaphor, and the brain is not a machine. It is plastic and living. Each time patients try to shift gears, they begin fixing their transmission by growing new circuits and altering the caudate. By refocusing, the patient is learning not to get sucked in by the content of an obsession, but to work around it. I suggest to my patients that they think of the use-it-or-lose-it principle. Each moment they spend thinking of the symptom, believing the germs are threatening them, they deepen the obsessive circuit. By bypassing it, they are on the road to losing it. With obsessions and compulsions, the more you do it, the more you want to do it. The less you do it, the less you want to do it. Schwartz has found it essential to understand that it is not what you feel while applying the technique that counts. It is what you do. The struggle is not to make the feeling go away. The struggle is not to give in to the feeling by acting out a compulsion or thinking about the obsession. This technique won't give immediate relief because lasting neuroplastic change takes time, but it does lay the groundwork for change by exercising the brain in a new way. So at first, one will still feel both the urge to enact the compulsion and the tension and anxiety that come from resisting it. The goal is to change the channel to some new activity for 15 to 30 minutes when one has an OCD symptom. If one can't resist that long, any time spent resisting is beneficial, even if it is only for a minute. That resistance, that effort, is what appears to lay down new circuits. One can see that Schwartz's techniques with OCD has parallels with Taub's CI approach to strokes. By forcing the patients to change the channel and refocus on a new activity, Schwartz is imposing a constraint like Taub's mitt. By getting his patients to concentrate on the new behavior intensively, in 30-minute segments, he is giving them masked practice. In Chapter 3, Redesigning the Brain, we learn two key laws of plasticity that also underlie this treatment. The first is that neurons that fire together wire together. By doing something pleasurable in place of the compulsion, patients form a new circuit that is gradually reinforced instead of the compulsion. The second law is that neurons that fire apart, wire apart. By not acting on their compulsions, patients weaken the link between the compulsion and the idea it will ease their anxiety. This delinking is crucial because, as we've seen, while acting on a compulsion eases anxiety in the short term, it worsens OCD in the long term. Schwartz has had good results with severe cases. 80% of his patients got better when they use his method in combination with medication. typically an antidepressant such as anafrenil or a Prozac-type drug. The medication functions like training wheels on a bike to ease anxiety or to lower it enough for patients to benefit from the therapy. In time, many patients get off the medication and some don't need it to start with. I have seen the brain lock approach work well with such typical OCD problems as fear of germs, hand washing, checking compulsions, compulsive second guessing, and incapacitating hypochondriacal fears. As patients apply themselves, the manual gear shift gets more and more automatic. The episodes become shorter and less frequent, and though patients can relapse during stressful times, they can quickly regain control using their newfound technique. When Schwartz and his team scanned the brains of their improved patients, they found that the three parts of the brain that had been locked and firing together in a hyperactive way had begun to fire separately in a normal way. The brain lock was being relieved. I was at a dinner party with a friend whom I shall call Emma, her writer husband Theodore, and several other writers. Emma is now in her 40s. When she was 23, a spontaneous genetic mutation led to an illness called retinitis pigmentosa that caused her retinal cells to die. 5 years ago, she became totally blind and began using a seeing eye dog, Maddie, a Labrador. Emma's blindness has reorganized her brain and her life. A number of us who were at the dinner are interested in literature, but since she has gone blind, Emma has done more reading than any of us. A computer program from Kurzweil Educational Systems reads books aloud to her in a monotone that pauses for commas, stops for periods, and rises in pitch for questions. This computer voice is so rapid I cannot make out a single word. But Emma has gradually learned to listen at a faster and faster pace, so she is now reading at about 340 words a minute and is marching through all the great classics. I get into an author and I read everything he has ever written, and then I move on to another. She has read Dostoevsky, her favorite, Gogol, Tolstoy, Turgenev, Dickens, Chesterton, Balzac, Hugo, Zola, Flaubert, Proust, Stendhal, and many others. Recently, she read 3 Trollope novels in one day. She asked me how it might be possible for her to read so much more quickly than before she went blind. I theorized that her massive visual cortex, no longer processing sight, had been taken over for auditory processing. That particular evening, Emma asked me if I knew anything about needing to check things a lot. She told me that she often has a lot of trouble getting out of the house because she keeps checking the stoves and the locks. Back when she was still going to her office, she might leave for work, get halfway there, and then have to go back to make sure she had locked the door properly. By the time she got back, she would feel obliged to check that the stove, electrical appliances, and water were turned off. She'd leave, then have to repeat the whole cycle several more times, all the while trying to fight the urge. She told me that her authoritarian father had made her anxious when she was growing up. When she left home, she'd lost that anxiety, but noticed that it now seemed to have been replaced by this checking, which kept getting worse. I explained the brain lock theory to her. I told her that often we check and recheck appliances without really concentrating. So I suggested she check once, and once only, with utmost care. The next time I saw her, she was delighted. "I'm better," she said. "I check once now, and I move on. I still feel the urge, but I resist it, and then it passes. And as I get more practice, it is passing more quickly." She gave her husband a mock scowl. He had joked that it was not polite to bother the psychiatrist with her neuroses while we were at a party. "Theodore," she said, "it's not that I'm crazy. It's just that my brain wasn't turning the page." Chapter 7. Pain. The Dark Side of Plasticity. When we wish to perfect our senses, neuroplasticity is a blessing. When it works in the service of pain, plasticity can be a curse. Our Guide to Pain is one of the most inspiring of the neuroplasticians, V.S. Ramachandran. Vilanayanar Subramanian Ramachandran was born in Madras, India. He is a neurologist of Hindu background and a proud relic of 19th century science who tackles 21st century dilemmas. Ramachandran is an MD, a specialist in neurology, with a PhD in psychology from Trinity College, Cambridge. We met in San Diego, where he directs the Center for Brain and Cognition at the University of California. Rama has black, wavy hair and wears a black leather jacket. His voice booms. His accent is British, but when he is excited, his R's are like a long drum roll. Whereas many neuroplasticians work to help people develop or recover skills to read, move, or overcome learning disabilities, Ramachandran uses plasticity to reconfigure the content of our minds. He shows that we can rewire our brains through comparatively brief, painless treatments that use imagination and perception. His office is filled not with high-tech devices, but rather with simple 19th-century machines, the little inventions that draw children to science. There is a stereoscope, an optical instrument that makes two pictures of the same scene look three-dimensional. There is a magnetic device that was once used to treat hysteria, some funhouse-type mirrors, magnifying glasses of early vintage, fossils, and the preserved brain of an adolescent. There is also a bust of Freud, a picture of Darwin, and some voluptuous Indian art. This could only be the office of one man, the Sherlock Holmes of modern neurology, V.S. Ramachandran. He is a sleuth, solving mysteries, one case at a time, as though utterly unaware that modern science is now occupied with large statistical studies. He believes that individual cases have everything to contribute to science. As he put it, imagine I were to present a pig to a skeptical scientist, insisting it could speak English, then waved my hand and the pig spoke English. Would it really make sense for the skeptic to argue? But that is just one pig, Ramachandran. Show me another, and I might believe you. He has repeatedly shown that by explaining neurological oddities, he can shed light on the functioning of normal brains. I hate crowds in science, he tells me. He doesn't fancy large scientific meetings either. I tell my students, when you go to these meetings, see what direction everyone is headed, so you can go in the opposite direction. Don't polish the brass on the bandwagon. Beginning at age 8, Ramachandran tells me he avoided sports and parties and progressed from one passion to another. Paleontology, he collected rare fossils in the field. Conchology, the study of seashells. Entomology, he has a special fondness for beetles. And botany, he cultivated orchids. His biography is scattered throughout his office in the form of beautiful natural objects, fossils, shells, insects, and flowers. Were he not a neurologist, he tells me, he would be an archaeologist studying ancient Sumer, Mesopotamia, or the Indus Valley. These essentially Victorian pursuits reveal his fondness for the science of that period, the golden age of taxonomy, when the learned ranged around the world using the naked eye and Darwinian detective work to catalog nature's variations and eccentricities, and weave them into broad theories that explain the great themes of the living world. Ramachandran approaches neurology the same way. In his early research, he investigated patients who experienced mental illusions. He studied people who, after brain injuries, began to believe they were prophets, or others suffering from Kapkra syndrome, who came to believe their parents and spouses were imposters, exact replicas of their real loved ones. He studied optical illusions and the eye's blind spots. As he figured out what was happening in each of these diseases, generally without the use of modern technology, he shed new light on how the normal brain works. I have a disdain, he says, for complicated fancy equipment because it takes a lot of time to learn how to use, and I'm suspicious when the distance between the raw data and the final conclusion is too long. It gives you plenty of opportunity to massage that data. And human beings are notoriously susceptible to self-deception, whether scientists or not. Ramachandran pulls out a large square box with a mirror standing inside it that looks like a child's magic trick. Using this box and his insights into plasticity, he solved the centuries-old mystery of phantom limbs and the chronic pain they engender. There are a whole host of haunting pains that torment us for reasons we do not understand, and that arrive from we know not where, pains without return address. Lord Nelson, the British Admiral, lost his right arm in an attack on Santa Cruz de Tenerife in 1797. Soon afterward, Ramachandran points out, he vividly began to experience the presence of his arm, a phantom limb that he could feel but not see. Nelson concluded that its presence was direct evidence for the existence of the soul, reasoning that if an arm can exist after being removed, so then might the whole person exist after the annihilation of the body. Phantom limbs are troubling because they give rise to a chronic phantom pain in 95% of amputees that often persists for a lifetime. But how do you remove a pain in an organ that isn't there? Phantom pain torments soldiers with amputations and people who lose limbs in accidents, but they are also part of a larger class of uncanny pains that have confused doctors for millennia, because they had no known source in the body. Even after routine surgery, some people are left with equally mysterious post-operative pains that last a lifetime. The scientific literature on pain includes stories of women who suffer menstrual cramps and labor pains even after their uteruses have been removed, of men who still feel ulcer pain after the ulcer and its nerve have been cut out, and of people who are left with chronic rectal and hemorrhoidal pain after their rectums have been removed. There are stories of people whose bladders were removed who still have an urgent, painful, chronic need to urinate. These episodes are comprehensible if we remember that they, too, are phantom pains, the result of internal organs being amputated. Normal pain, acute pain, alerts us to injury or disease by sending a signal to the brain saying, "This is where you hurt, attend to it." But sometimes an injury can damage both our bodily tissues and the nerves in our pain systems, resulting in neuropathic pain, for which there is no external cause. Our pain maps get damaged and fire incessant false alarms, making us believe the problem is in our body when it is in our brain. Long after the body has healed, the pain system is still firing and the acute pain has developed an afterlife. The phantom limb was first proposed by Silas Weir Mitchell, an American physician who tended the wounded at Gettysburg and became intrigued by an epidemic of phantoms. Civil War soldiers, wounded arms and legs, often turn gangrenous, and in an age before antibiotics, the only way to save the soldier's life was to amputate the limb before the gangrene spread. Soon amputees began to report that their limbs had returned to haunt them. Mitchell first called these experiences sensory ghosts, then switched to calling them phantom limbs. They are often very lively entities. Patients who have lost arms can sometimes feel them gesticulating when they talk, waving hello to friends, or reaching spontaneously for a ringing phone. A few doctors thought the phantom was the product of wishful thinking, a denial of the painful loss of a limb. But most assumed that the nerve endings on the stump end of the lost limb were being stimulated or irritated by movement. Some doctors tried to deal with phantoms by serial amputations, cutting back the limbs and nerves farther and farther, hoping the phantom might disappear. But after each surgery, it reemerged. Ramachandran had been curious about phantoms since medical school. Then in 1991, he read the paper by Tim Pons and Edward Taub about the final operations on the Silver Spring monkeys. As you'll recall, Pons mapped the brains of the monkeys who had had all the sensory input from their arms to their brains eliminated by deafferentation, and found that the brain map for the arm, instead of wasting away, had become active and now processed input from the face, which might be expected because, as Wilder Penfield had shown, the hand and facial maps are side by side. Ramachandran immediately thought that plasticity might explain phantom limbs because Taub's monkeys and patients with phantom arms were similar. The brain maps for both the monkeys and the patients had been deprived of stimuli from their limbs. Was it possible that the face maps of amputees had invaded the maps of their missing arms, so that when the amputee was touched on the face, he felt his phantom arm? And where, Ramachandran wondered, did Taub's monkeys feel it when their faces were stroked? on their faces, or in their deafferented arm. Tom Sorensen, a pseudonym, was only 17 years old when he lost his arm in an automobile accident. As he was hurled into the air, he looked back and saw his hand, severed from his body, still grabbing the seat cushion. What remained of his arm had to be amputated just above the elbow. About 4 weeks later, he became aware of a phantom limb that did many of the things his arm used to do. It reached out reflexively to break a fall or to pat his younger brother. Tom had other symptoms, including one that really irked him. He had an itch in his phantom hand that he couldn't scratch. Ramachandran heard of Tom's amputation from colleagues and asked to work with him. To test his theory that phantoms were caused by rewired brain maps, he blindfolded Tom. Then he stroked parts of Tom's upper body with a Q-tip, asking Tom what he felt. When he got to Tom's cheek, Tom told him he felt it there, but also in his phantom. When Ramachandran stroked Tom's upper lip, he felt it there, but also in the index finger of his phantom. Ramachandran found that when he touched other parts of Tom's face, Tom felt it in other parts of his phantom hand. When Ramachandran put a drop of warm water on Tom's cheek, he felt a warm trickle move down his cheek and also down his phantom limb. Then, after some experimentation, Tom found that he could finally scratch the unscratchable itch that had plagued him for so long by scratching his cheek. After Ramachandran's success with the Q-tip, he went high-tech with a brain scan called an MEG, or magnetoencephalography. When he mapped Tom's arm and hand, the scan confirmed that his hand map was now being used to process facial sensations. His hand and face maps had blurred together. Ramachandran's finding in the Tom Sorensen case, at first controversial among clinical neurologists who doubted brain maps were plastic, is now widely accepted. Brain scan studies by the German team that Taub works with have also confirmed a correlation between the amount of plastic change and the degree of phantom pain people experience. Ramachandran strongly suspects that one reason map invasion occurs is that the brain sprouts new connections. When a part of the body is lost, he believes, its surviving brain map hungers for incoming stimulation and releases nerve growth factors that invite neurons from nearby maps to send little sprouts into them. Normally, these little sprouts link up to similar nerves. Nerves for touch link with other nerves for touch. But our skin, of course, conveys far more than touch. It has distinct receptors that detect temperature, vibration, and pain as well, each with its own nerve fibers that travel up to the brain, where they have their own maps, some of which are very near each other. Sometimes after an injury, because the nerves for touch, temperature, and pain are so close together, there can be cross-wiring errors. So, Ramachandran wondered, might a person who is touched, in cases of cross-wiring, feel pain or warmth? Could a person who was touched gently on the face feel pain in a phantom arm? Another reason phantoms are so unpredictable and cause so much trouble is that brain maps are dynamic and changing. Even under normal circumstances, as Mrzenek showed, face maps tend to move around a bit in the brain. Phantom maps move because their input has been so radically changed. Ramachandran and others, Taub and his colleagues among them, have shown with repeated scans of brain maps that the contours of phantoms and their maps are constantly changing. He thinks one reason people get phantom pain is that when a limb is cut off, its map not only shrinks, but gets disorganized and stops working properly. Not all phantoms are painful. After Ramachandran published his discoveries, amputees began to seek him out. Several leg amputees reported, with much shame, that when they had sex, they often experienced their orgasms in their phantom legs and feet. One man confessed that because his leg and foot were so much larger than his genitals, the orgasm was much bigger than it used to be. Though such patients might once have been dismissed as having overly rich imaginations, Ramachandran argued that the claim made perfect neuroscientific sense. The Penfield brain map shows the genitals next to the feet, and since the feet no longer receive input, the genital maps likely invade the foot maps. So when the genitals experience pleasure, so do the phantom feet. Ramachandran began to wonder whether some people's erotic preoccupation with feet, or foot fetishes, might be due in part to the proximity of feet and genitals on the brain map. Other erotic enigmas fell into place. An Italian physician, Dr. Salvatore Agliotti, reported that some women who have had mastectomies experience sexual excitement when their ears, clavicles, and sternums are stimulated. All three are close to nipples on the brain map. Some men with carcinoma of the penis who have had their penises amputated experience not only phantom penises, but phantom erections. As Ramachandran examined more amputees, he learned that about half of them have the unpleasant feeling that their phantom limbs are frozen, hanging in a fixed, paralyzed position or encased in cement. Others feel they are lugging around a dead weight. And not only do images of paralyzed limbs get frozen in time, but in some horrific cases, the original agony of losing the limb is locked in. When grenades blow up in a soldier's hands, they can develop a phantom pain that endlessly repeats the excruciating moment of the explosion. Ramachandran encountered a woman whose frostbitten thumb was amputated and whose phantom froze the agonizing frostbite pains in place. People are tortured by phantom memories of gangrene, ingrown toenails, blisters, and cuts felt in the limb before it was amputated, especially if that pain existed at the time of the amputation. These patients experience such agonies not as faint memories of pain, but as happening in the present. Sometimes a patient can be pain-free for decades, and then an event, perhaps a needle inserted in a trigger point,